wrapping the kids out of their coats, the way the babies haven't been born. Oh, 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 oh.
Welcome to Teacher Besties, a podcast for teachers. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Kelly. On this week's agenda, we will rehash my teaching tolerance training and the importance of teaching a diverse curriculum. We will also talk about a new article in the New Yorker about educators who are learning how to interrogate their students in a police interrogation technique and how controversial that is. We will run down some news like Georgia voting against students being able to practice yoga for various reasons, and some other things in the news that I have been keeping tabs on.
That sounds great. Before I'm polite and ask you about your conference, I want to tell you about my day today because it was kind of hilarious.
Awesome. Tell me.
I played a review game, a Kahoot, with my students, and I think I've talked about it before. I give them a head start, and then I see who I can pass. And if they finish ahead of me, I give them extra credit.
That sounds awesome.
I know. I really am a little too competitive. Anyway, so my first period, I finished 12th out of 35. I thought that was commendable.
Nice. Well, how far of a head start do you give them?
Between 5 and 10 questions, depending on the class.
Nice.
And then third period, I finished in 7th. But my best was in 5th period. You want to guess what place I finished in?
Second
place.
Shots fired at 5th period. I just gotta say, you are calling them out as basically being the slow period.
Well, that's the best thing is, like, there's so many really, really smart kids, and I kind of felt really bad. And then the girl in first place, I thought she was gonna have, like, a panic attack, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, but I gave all the top 10 finishers extra credit because I'm a pushover.
Oh, that's so nice of you.
Well, I thought it was kind of mean. I was, like, being really aggressive.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was not mean and that it was in good spirits.
Yeah, it was mostly for entertainment purposes. There's only so many times you could play a game before you're a little bored.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that was my fun for the day. Tell me about your conference.
Okay.
What was it?
So if I sound like super excited, but also like overwhelmed, it's because I had a really great professional development conference that I went to, but that it was also like an experience that is both emotionally draining and also like that great experience that you have where you're like, I've got so many teacher ideas, but so little time to implement them. So
was it just one day?
No, so it was 2 days. So I flew down to LA with some other colleagues, both in English and the social studies department. We went to the Museum of Tolerance in Beverly Hills. And the conference was being put on by the Teaching Tolerance Organization, which is like a subset of the Southern Poverty Law Center they're like out of Montgomery, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put this on. So part of how the training is run is that like every morning you spend like 2 or 3 hours in the museum doing a section of the museum that like essentially it's like there's the Holocaust section of the museum and then there's the civil rights section of the museum. And then there's some other exhibits, but those were the two main ones that we explored. They're both like, you know, very moving, very interesting, like lots of information, kind of immerse you in the experience, you know, as you can imagine, if you've ever been to any of those museums or like the Holocaust Museum in DC, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's just one of those experiences where like by the end, you're like very drained, crying often and like, it's super important, but you know, you just feel really tired.
So far, exactly what you want in a development program. Around crying.
Well, okay.
I know. But I'm being mean. Continue.
You know, it like sets up, it sets the stage for like this social justice curriculum that they teach. So So the stuff that we learned then in like the afternoon from the facilitator, who was fabulous.
What kind of credentials does the facilitator have? Are they just associated with the museum or the project?
So she was like a teacher for years and years and years. And then, she's been developing material for the Southern Poverty Law Center for like, I don't know, it seems like quite a while. So,
okay, that's awesome. I think that I would like that job when I'm done with my current job.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. So some of the material, like I'm really excited to talk about the resources that they have on their websites because, you know, you don't have to go to this training to get access to them.
That's great.
So one of the things that like is a central focus during this training is the importance of a diverse curriculum and having...
What do you mean by diverse?
So like across a lot of different spectrums. So like ability level, race, gender, socioeconomic background, class, place. So the basically if you look at their resources, they have it organized that way as well online.
Oh, so look at them.
Yeah. So if you go to perspectives.tolerance.org, that will take you straight to this curriculum. They have a great website, which is just tolerance.org, but it kind of, you know, they have so many materials that you can kind of get lost in the weeds. So if you go to the perspectives.tolerance.org section, it takes you straight to this anti-bias curriculum that they have, and it's organized in a bunch of different ways. So like you can click on Central Text Anthology, and they have broken down like a few hundred texts at this point. They have informational texts, literature, multimedia, and visuals. They're all categorized by like they're aligned to the Common Core. They're Ooh. Categorized by grade level from K through 12. By the type, whether you want literature, maybe you want, let's say you want a piece of literature about class or about immigration. Let's click immigration. And then let's say you can also go further and break it down by themes like individuals in society or power and privilege or rights and responsibilities, and click on it and then, you know, see what you get. And
so is there a full lesson plan for everything or some sort of like content for you to use?
Yeah. So the thing I just described is just the text at that point, but the text is even, if you look at it, it's like, you can also click on some things on the side, which will highlight it for you by themes and, or like standards that they've already broken out.
And do you have to register in order to do this?
You do, but it's completely free.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So yeah, you have to give them your email address, like create an account basically. But,
so what sources came up when you just did that quick little search?
So I just got something called 17 Syllables by it looks like a Japanese woman, which is, and then, The Fire Horse Girl by Kay Honeyman, about a young Chinese girl, and then a Dave Eggers piece from What is the What? Cool. So like, And that was just like literature, something very specific. Now to get to your question about like the concrete lessons and stuff, they also have a section that's called tasks and strategies. So you can click on that. And part of this framework that they've built is that they've also separated it into like social justice standards, identity, diversity, justice, and action. So, like, they break those down in really manageable ways as well. So there's writing tasks, which are kind of like your typical, like, they have, like, narrative, argumentative, or argumentation, like, all mm-hmm. those different kinds of writing tasks. The do somethings tend to be more, like, if you want to teach your students how to take action about something, like, you know, you've been spent all this time talking about justice and their identities and things like that. And then they're like, okay, what do I do with this? So there are things like writing letters to your local officials.
Yeah.
Starting like one thing is like starting a Twitter campaign. One thing is, let's see, community this one's for like K through 12, but I mean K through 2, but all right, I'm going into the weeds here, but
okay, that's okay. I think we get the gist of it.
Yeah. Anyway, it was like, it was very inspiring to have these conversations about these things. And part of the reason why I felt like something that they brought up that I thought was just really striking was, during the training, she put up this one of her slides, which was they took the Common Core State Text exemplars, mm-hmm. Which are like, you know, listed in the, like when you get the Common Core.
It's the books you're supposed to read, right, or the literature that comes with the learning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the books that they recommend, they broke it down. 88 of the books that were recommended, 69 of the authors were white. All of the stories recommended for kindergarten and first grade were white. All of the stories for second through third grade were white. So basically you had to get to fourth grade before you read anybody that was not white.
Hmm.
And then 6 out of the 88 books focused on the poor or working class. So it was a little disheartening to read that. And like one of the responses was that the Southern Poverty Law Center, like they responded to this by basically saying to the Common Core, like, that is not okay. You need to like include some diverse voices in your curriculum. And part of the problem with that is that Common Core was like, 49 of the states had already adopted the Common Core. And they were like, well, we're not going to do that because then we have to go get them to readopt it. So they just put like an appendix in that says,
that's crazy.
Here's some things you could do. But you know, I feel like we all encounter this when we're trying to get diversity into our curriculum. There's always people that will say, you know, if they don't read The Great Gatsby, they're going to be shut out of conversations in college about this one book. And
that's not true. No one talked about that in college.
I don't know. I just think like all that does is reinforce the idea that this is what the status quo is, and that if you want to be taken seriously, you basically have to just read the status quo dominant culture literature.
Yeah. Kind of makes me glad, one, that I teach a subject, I don't know if I've said this, that technically doesn't have any state standards I'm supposed to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I go with like Common Core writing standards, and that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
But like I can, whatever content I want, that's mine. I get to pick it. Yeah. So, I mean, I told you last week that I was talking about the Congo Wars, which are not covered anywhere. And mm-hmm. today I talked about apartheid, which most of them did not know what that word meant or where it was. And then there was like a compare and contrast with the Constitution created in 1994 there. And it's like, I got to do that and expose them to something new.
That's
and
really
thoughtful.
Cool.
I know.
So
would you recommend your in-service training, whatever you want to call it?
100%. I mean, the only drawback is that it is exhausting, and you oftentimes go right back into the classroom, like after flying in and then flying out and 2 days of intensive training. It's really tiring, but, you know, in the best way possible, right? Like you come away invigorated with great ideas and like really believing that the work is important.
That's good. So do you feel like you're recharged? Your creative juices are like there and ready to go again?
Yeah, I feel really good. I would say the line between what I was saying about the lack of diverse voices. The cool thing about this is that they have taken really great texts that are diverse. They've categorized it in a way that if you're like, okay, this voice is missing from my curriculum, there's a really easy, accessible way for teachers to get it. And it's in chunks that you can easily print.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. So like, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we went and looked up to see if there was anything on apartheid.
Oh, I would definitely bring it in next week. I would find something good. I would love that. Some kids in my first period were like outraged. I'm like, it's not all that different from what happened in the United States.
Right. Like, oh, what? It was just 30 years later.
About.
So, I mean, yeah, it is outrageous, but that's, I guess, what happens when they're kind of sheltered from that truth, right?
And, I mean, to be fair, like, these kids are 14 and 15. Like, they haven't really had a chance to learn that kind of history yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I would also push back a little bit and say that, like, we tend to shelter our kids from that kind of stuff until high school.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is interesting because on my ride home from the airport with my colleague's daughter goes to a very progressive private school in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And she's 10 and she was like telling us all about the civil rights movement that she was learning about, but like in a very detailed manner. And I was thinking, many of my juniors don't know these things. And I think sometimes it's because we sort of, you know, at the younger levels, we oftentimes, for whatever reason, think that like they can't handle it or.
Yeah. When I was back in teacher school, the elementary people in the credential program, there was often conversations about like how to teach the true nature of Columbus to children rather than glorifying him. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot done. There's a lot of history resources done to try to explain those deeper truths. And clearly your colleague's daughter is experiencing them.
Oh, that's cool. It's nice to hear that conversation is happening.
Yeah. All right. So overall, teaching tolerance. Good job.
Yeah, really awesome. I would recommend people explore their resources. And also, extra plug, they have a free magazine that they release quarterly that you can sign up for, and they also have tons and tons of like actual DVDs and things like that that they release, things that actually win like short documentary Oscars. And then
I've watched a few of them. They'll send them a really good one on Rosa Parks.
Yeah, and they'll send them to you for free, so like take advantage of all the free resources.
Yes, I agree. So next we're going to talk about interrogating students.
Oh, no.
There was a New Yorker article called Why Are Educators Learning How to Interrogate Their Students? It's from last week, March 25th, if you want to go check it out later. Mm-hmm. And it starts off talking about this method called the Reed Technique of Interrogation, which is actually a 9-step police interrogation system.
Oh, my God.
And if I've really just read the Wikipedia page about it, it seems kind of terrifying. I think if someone interrogated me like this, I would cry. Which, by the way, in interrogating children is kind of the point, which I don't know if you caught that, but clearly sarcastic.
Right.
Or outrage, whatever that emotion is. Anyway, so there's 3 components when interrogating students at schools, and they are to investigate, then do a behavioral analysis. Like, look, well, if the child is slumping or falling or not looking at the interviewer or giving evasive responses, so typical teenager, then generally that shows that they are lying.
Right.
But again, those types of behaviors in teenagers aren't all that uncommon, so it's very difficult to tell.
It's actually laughable. Like, the way they describe it is like, oh, if the student's evading your eye contact, slumped over. I'm like, oh, you mean like a normal teenager?
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
And then the last step is finally analyzing your interview with the subject. And so the language that they use in the article and also the Reed method, they never refer to them as children or students or kids. They're only called suspects or subjects, which is obviously like the first huge red flag.
Yeah.
Also, second huge red flag is that the article mentions not just interrogating students, but also teachers, which I was like, what?
No, that is not okay.
No, it's not okay. And so the person who this is about, they went to a conference, they were kind of outraged, but they said that all these other teachers at the conference were really excited to learn about the technique because they want to find out, like, quote, how we can learn to get the drop on Little Billy for writing graffiti on the underside of the lunchroom table, which, wow. Like, if that's your biggest problem, Also, please don't use the read technique of interrogation.
Also, if that is the thing that you really want to get to as an educator, like, you might have your priorities out of whack, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Can I just insert this name here that, like, was at the center of investigating this was, like, someone from the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law, right?
Yes.
Okay. Go.
Okay. And so one person at the conference said that the first thing that they do when they interrogate students is take away their cell phones so they can't call their mothers, which, like, I get it that at school students don't have as many rights, and it's under the guise of protecting everyone. And in theory, there is some truth to that. But in practice, especially in this situation, it's really not okay. Obviously, it's legal. Students have less rights at school than they do outside of school. Administrators and, in fact, teachers can search through students' backpacks without calling their parents, without getting their permission, without a search warrant. You know, that whole concept in locus parenti. But at the same time, I personally, and I know you personally, would never ever do that.
Never. I would never search a kid's backpack. I mean, so my feeling on this tends to be like, I don't have a problem with an administrator searching a child's backpack. I do have a problem with them restricting their access to their parent. I feel like if you're going to subject them to this, like, particularly kids, like, a lot of times in this article, they're talking about kids that are 12, 10, younger, and applying these kinds of interrogation.
Oh, you'll be nice to know that the article says, and the training for school says, that you shouldn't interrogate children under 10 like this.
Yeah. But it just seems like they need their parent as their advocate, you know, like, it's the same kind of idea that, like, you should have legal representation before you speak about these things.
Correct. And so there's a really great quote by this guy in the article who's a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. And he says that most of the time kids confess because, quote, all the kids are thinking is, how do I get out of here without my parents finding out?
Right. And that's true for innocent kids, too, because if you're a good kid, you don't want anybody to know you got called into the principal's office.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just humiliating. Everybody that's a teacher knows that as soon as somebody comes into your room and hands them a note and says they're getting called out to the office, the first thing the kids do is go, ooh, and chances are they're just going there because their mom dropped something off for them. But, like, you're immediately looked at as like, ooh, you did something.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to go back to the process, what you're supposed to do is ask some sort of, like, punishment question. So to try to get the, quote, suspect to be in your place and say, well, what do you think should happen to a person who did this? And if a student replies that they should be punished or expelled or suspended, then they would be innocent. But if someone's being deceptive, the person tries to, like, rationalize the action. So saying it depends on what he or she did. Like, if they did X, then they deserve Y. And if they did A, they deserve B.
Wow.
And so then the best part of the article for me is when they say that when you get to tears, that tears are the beginning of a confession. And you should say, quote, glad to see those tears because it tells me that you're sorry, aren't you?
That is terrible. I think the last part that you said about, like, if they say something like, well, it depends on why the person did it or how, it's like, how about that's just a kid that has some critical thinking skills? Like, you know, like, maybe they're just not black and white. Maybe they realize there's a little bit of gray area sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the article then looks at the confession rates of mm-hmm. students who falsely confessed, and that's actually 42%.
Wow.
Yeah. And
there's so much shaking of my head going on right now for the listeners.
And by comparison, if you want to know the adult number, only 8% of adults falsely confessed under the Reed technique.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we should also point out, like, that the article, like, talks a little bit about how children are highly, you know, they're highly influenced and can be coerced very easily by adults.
Correct. Absolutely. And so I really appreciated the way this article ended, because obviously it talks about the faults, not just like informational information on the read tactic. It says that what a lot of students need is a sense that adults are actually there for them and an authority that they can trust. And in utilizing the read style techniques, that it's creating a relationship of distrust and like becoming an unapproachable adult for a child.
Yeah. Wow.
The read tactic.
It really makes interesting. Me take some long sighs. I mean, I don't know what it's like to be an administrator, and I realize that I think that most administrators have good intentions, which is to keep the school safe.
Correct.
And to keep children, you know, behaving honestly and morally and doing things that are not going to hurt them. But I also think that if children are being treated this way, particularly at a young age, they're going to start to see, you know, their teachers, their administrators, police, adult figures around them as just figures that are there to have punitive punishment, and that, like, you know, it's just there to hurt them and not, like, I don't know, get them back on the right track.
Correct. And so it's actually really awesome that in 2014, rather than creating this like endless cycle of like, oh, you're in kindergarten, you're getting in trouble, in first grade, you're going to continue to get in trouble, that people are working on a rehabilitative process and issuing a therapeutic approach towards students who misbehave rather than perpetuating the cycle of misbehavior. And then obviously that cycle lends itself toward like the juvenile detention facilities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go ahead.
And if you want to think like really longitudinally, if you kind of nip it in the bud and go through this therapeutic behavior earlier on, it kind of fixes all the issues we have with people getting out of jail and then not being rehabilitated to be normal functioning members of society.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this just makes me think of all of those instances where you hear about kindergartners being suspended and expelled.
Oh my God.
I mean, which just makes me think, like, I don't think you should be allowed to be suspended when you're in kindergarten. Like,
unless you bring some sort of weapon to school.
Yeah.
And if you hurt somebody.
Also, if you're five and you bring a weapon to school, like, what are the chances that you really know what's like the, like, weight or the gravity of what you just did? Like, I don't know. There's just so many questions where you're like, really? What's the thought process here on the adult side?
Yeah. So. Very, very interesting.
Very
read.
Interesting. Yeah. Troubling, but interesting.
Okay. You want to talk about something funny now?
Okay.
Or what I perceive to be funny?
I perceive it to be disturbing.
Okay. So the next one is from the Washington Post, and it's about yoga. And it's called Georgia Parents Are Offended by the Far East Religion of Yoga, and they get namaste banned from school.
Oh, my goodness.
So let's start with what namaste actually means.
What does it mean?
It actually means the... Oh, shoot. Hold on. The... Peace in me finds the peace in you. Is that what it is?
I don't know. I just say it at the end of yoga. I have no idea what it means.
All right. Now I have to look it up.
I just think it means, thank you for teaching me to sweat. I will be going now.
Namaste. Fairly confident it's the peace in me finds the peace in you.
That sounds pretty good.
So
basically what? These teachers were teaching mindfulness, meditation,
yoga. Yeah, so
yoga.
There was a mindfulness exercise to de-stress. And this is at a school in what I think is in a rural or a more rural part of Georgia.
Oh, I think Kennesaw, Georgia.
Yeah. Not exactly sure where that is. It's at an elementary school. And instead of parents being thankful that they're working on de-stressing students, the parents thought that teaching yoga represented an encroachment on non-Christian beliefs.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you what I really think.
Okay, I have some words too, but you go first.
Okay, so I feel like this is, well, first of all, this is clearly like sort of the dominant culture, in this case, Christianity, being like, if I can't bring it into my school, if I can't bring my culture into your school, then nobody can.
Correct.
My feeling on this is sort of like, instead of pretending that our students don't practice religion, like, or that like freedom of religion means like we can never talk about religion in school, instead it should be that we should acknowledge that our students practice religion, that there are other religions in the world besides whatever the dominant religion is where you live, and that learning about those does not mean that you need to believe them.
Correct. And so the ACLU is very specific. They have like a really wonderful page that pretty much interprets Ed Code and religion's place in Ed Code. Mm-hmm. And obviously we, in this country, we have a very distinct separation of church and state, mm-hmm. which is wonderful. However, some people, there's a very gray line. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's like looking at the over-Christianization of schools, or I guess saying namaste when you're teaching students how to be calm, mm-hmm. As long as you're not actually teaching students a religion, mm-hmm. you are totally in the clear. Yeah. So students have a right to pray in their own time on campus, or if there's any downtime in the classroom, mm-hmm. They can excuse themselves. You as an educator are not allowed to pray with children at all. So hypothetically, if there was a Christian club and you were the advisor for said club, you wouldn't actually be allowed to pray with them. You could be in the room, but you, if you wanted to pray at school as a teacher, you would have to go either to your own classroom with the door closed and no students, or to like a faculty dining room or some staff space.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Friend of the podcast, Mark, and I had a very wonderful conversation about this actually, I think yesterday after school.
Cool. Jews were representing.
Yes, we were. Nice. And so as somebody who is not usually in the cultural majority, it's very easy for me to understand this. And so if you have any sort of empathy or have had to like overcome a plight where you're not in the mm-hmm. majority, it's totally understandable.
Yeah.
What's not understandable is why students wouldn't, or why parents wouldn't want their students to relax and stretch yeah. and be more limber.
Well, I mean, I guess I just, you know, I sort of see this as like a, well, you know, if it's not just going to be our way, then we're going to be vindictive and ban everything. And instead it should be, you know, my family's Christian, this family at this school is this, you know, we have a Muslim family at school. Like maybe we should just learn about each other, ask things, and not feel like those religions are being imposed on us. You know, I mean, I feel like everybody in these kinds of conversations, the first thing they go to is that we say the Pledge of Allegiance with under God in it. And like, I think a great lesson is to tell students that in that respect, like you don't have to say the pledge. You don't have to say the under God part. You can say the under God part. This is a part of our history. This is why we say it, you know? And
I mean, I like to tell them that under God wasn't there until the 1950s.
Yeah, like just give them cultural context, historical context. And
the only thing I require during the pledge, by the way, mm-hmm. is that it's respectful to stand up. You don't even have to put your hand on your heart. You just have to stand.
Yeah. I mean, I usually just tell them that they need to be quiet while others, you know, choose to stand up and do it or not. So I think it's just about teaching like respect for others, and respect for other means respecting that other people have different views, and not if you won't let me do my thing, you can't do yours.
Correct.
And I'm not going to learn about anything else.
I guess I'm curious what the parents think is actually happening. Like, I feel like yoga is so mainstream. I find it very surprising. I've heard some people who like, and not in schools, but like in the real world mm-hmm. outside of school, who don't like to chant because they feel like there's a lot of religiosity associated with it in yoga.
Sure.
I don't like to chant because I'm like the biggest introvert ever. And, and I just can't, like, I find myself incapable of doing that.
Yeah.
But I could see like, it would be like a very cathartic relief.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I can forgive it. Like, no problem.
Right.
But namaste, stop being silly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that there it's a very obvious target on what it is and not what it's about, sadly.
So. I just want to ask them, like, do you want other kinds of people to move to Georgia? Do you want your kids to grow up to be white elitists? Because that's how you make that happen.
Right.
By making namaste go away.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, no. That's brought us like full circle back to the introduction.
Oh, look at that. That wasn't even on purpose.
I also wanted to make like a really quick kind of like announcement because I was so happy when I learned this the other day. That this week an anonymous donor gave $34 million to Oakland Unified School District.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. It's said that like they don't know. It's like it's still a mystery who made the donation.
That's beautiful.
So really cool.
That is really cool.
Very, very exciting. But I'll be curious to see, you know, what they use it for. $34 million can go pretty quickly if not used wisely in a large urban district like Oakland. But, you know, it's really, really cool that whoever did that is making something really awesome happen for some students.
Do you know how many high schools, Oakland Unified has?
You know what? I don't know exactly. I can think of...
That's what I'll look it up later.
I can think of like 4 or 5 off the top of my head. There are lots of charter schools in Oakland. So like I'm thinking of like the 4 sort of traditional schools that are under the umbrella of the district. And then there's also Oakland School of the Arts, which is public, but technically a charter, I believe. And you have to audition to get in there. And then there's a vast network of charters in Oakland.
And do they fall under the umbrella of Oakland Unified?
In the sense that like they're funded in part, at least by public monies. And also that like your student, you know, like they're public schools, you know, so like the kids, they either enter a lottery or they apply in some way, but I think that there are a lot of limits on how selective they can actually be. It can't be like a private school. So, but I know that like it's very noticeable in the community. So like just
15,
in my small neighborhood,
15 public high schools, sorry, in the district. Oh. I just looked it up. Yeah.
Really? Wow.
I know. It's huge.
That's shocking. I don't even know where all those high schools are because like, yeah, I mean, there's a number of really big ones that you just sort of
see. Is Castlemont one? Because yes. I recognize that road name.
Yeah, that's a really big one. But just in my little small neighborhood, there's 3 elementary schools that used to all be like public Oakland public schools, and 2 out of the 3 now are charters.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Anyway, so are you doing – sorry, I'm changing the subject.
It's okay.
Did you have to do that training, the smarter balance training for your students? Are you doing standardized tests this year?
I am doing standardized tests. I have not been trained yet. I'm not sure if this is an accurate statement, but I feel like we do our tests later than your school does.
I don't even know when my school does it this year because guess what? I don't have to proctor anything.
Oh, good for you.
I know. I'm very excited.
Yeah. I mean, I was just reading that like comical list of like the 10 stages of proctoring standardized tests.
Oh my God. You know? I just remembered namaste.
Did the standardized test proctoring make you
think of it? I guess so. I don't know. The light in me sees the light in you, not the peace in me. Ugh. A little too late.
Wow. What a terrible thing to say to one another.
I know. God. How annoyingly positive.
I know.
Anyway, sorry.
It's not like...
Back to standardized tests.
So I'm not looking forward to May, mostly because the first 2 weeks of May are AP testing, and then the second 2 weeks are Smarter Balance testing.
That's so much.
And so since I teach primarily juniors, it's like a month of testing for
them. Poor kids. And poor us. It's so boring.
Yes.
It's well, terrible. Poor you, not poor me.
So I will probably only be affected in the sense that, like, for the first 2 weeks of May, many of my students will be absent all the time because they'll be taking tests or they'll be fried from taking the tests. And then in like 1 week, I proctor the English test. And then when they take the math tests, I don't know what I do.
Well, last year I colored during the test. I don't know if that's allowed.
Yeah, I mean, I usually grade. Like, I'll try to assign something that needs a lot of time to grade. But coloring sometimes is, you know, my version of namaste. So I'll do that as well.
Yeah. I guess I feel bad for all my colleagues. I know they've had to sit through the training. And, you know...
Was it really that intense this year?
I mean, it's the same as last year. It's like you have to make an account and be all ready to be digitized. And
yeah, I mean, I guess because it's like the first few years of a test that's now being taken on computers, there's probably every year sort of like some kinks that they're working out.
And then you have to sign the affidavit. And then like I feel like that's like makes it more intense.
Yeah, right. Like, sign this thing saying that they can sue you if you mess up proctoring the thing you had to do for your job. Yeah.
And then me, like, you know me, I read the directions like 5 times. I'm like, I don't understand this. And last year, I had to teach about, like, a fountain to my students because I was proctoring the math test. And we had to teach about floating fountains. And I'm like, I don't know what this means. And another teacher had to explain it to me. Which then some kids were like, this wasn't on the test.
Oh. Yeah. Weird. Yeah.
Anyway, glad I don't have to do that.
Yeah, I have to. I know that as part of the English exam, they have a listening portion now. So, like, you know, they have to have headphones and they have to know that they can, like, pause and replay and go back. And it's just, like, a lot of practicing how to do the test so that they can do it right. Whenever people that are not in the teaching profession, like, say, I don't understand why you have to take time to teach them how to take the test. I'm like, well, if you've ever worked with young people who oftentimes need, or really adults too, like, who need practice with, like, the technology or the way that you're supposed to do something and not just the content, it takes a little bit of time.
It does. I'm curious if we're going to have another situation. Last year, like the students, I think it was in Washington State where they walked out of the test or chose not to show up to school. I wonder if...
Yeah, that was big time in Washington State.
I'm curious if that's going to happen again this year.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually surprised. Like, I get that they're showing... It's a statement when they walk out. But I'm... It's like they do know that they can also just like sign a thing that says they don't want their children to take it.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. I don't know. So, I know that. You know that. Now Everyone who listens knows. But
right.
So maybe not the parents of Washington State. We don't have any friends there.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know you're looking forward to something exciting.
Yes, I'm going to Hawaii in less than 48 hours.
I'm so envious. I'm very excited. So envious. Have a good time.
I will.
Get some sun.
I will. Hopefully I won't get burned.
Yeah, wear some sunscreen.
I'm doing zero schoolwork, and I'm bringing some books to read for pleasure.
That's fantastic. I have a lot of schoolwork to do because
Well, you don't have a week off.
No, not yet.
You have to wait.
I have to wait a little bit, but I will get my work done, and then I will do nothing on my week, too.
Yay.
Do you want to tell everyone where they can find us? Because you're way better at that.
Yes, you can find us at teacherbestiespodcast@tumblr.com, where we will list the links to you know, all the things we talked about today. You can email us at teacherbesties@gmail.com, and you can find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Have a good week. Enjoy your break.
Bye.
Bye.
Talk to the neighbors and tip my cap on little rug belly. Oh.